The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, there might be some goldfish swallowing going on here. If you were listening here yesterday, you heard me talk about my experience with demonstrations on college campuses a million years ago. I'm one of them baby boomers, and my generation, I think, you know, kind of invented mass demonstrations on college campuses, and I mentioned that it was my experience that at least half of the people who showed up for the demonstrations were there because it was a happening. And, you know, demonstrations became kind of a fad, you know, like goldfish swallowing, seeing how many guys you could stuff in a phone booth, that kind of stuff. So I noticed today that Fox News had to run a scroll on screen to show the number of colleges where major demonstrations are taking place now, anti-Israel demonstrations. So it is catching on. And again, this is not to say that there aren't lots and lots of legitimately passionate people demonstrating for or against a cause. It's just that when you see the numbers reported and the size of the crowds, it should be understood that in some respects it might just be a party going on for a lot of people. Here's an example. This NYU student, she showed up to demonstrate. An interviewer asks her what she's demonstrating for or against. Why is she there? And listen closely. After she gives her non-answer, she turns to her friend, who, by the way, is wearing a mask. You really won't be able to understand what she says, but she asks her why they're there, and she doesn't know either. Listen.
And what would you say is the main goal with tonight's protest?
I think the goal is just showing our support for Palestine and demanding that NYU stop. I honestly don't know all of what NYU's doing.
Is there something that NYU's doing?
I really don't know. I'm pretty sure they're... Do you know what NYU's doing?
About what?
About Israel. Why are we protesting here?
Palestine will be free!
I wish I was more educated.
I'm not either.
Oh.
I came from Columbia. I was there off at Columbia, and we came down. They said NYU...
Okay, you're losing it there because the audio is not great, but she says, I wish I was more educated. That's what her friend, who's wearing a mask, by the way, is she hiding, or does she still think that there's COVID out there that's going to get her? She's wearing a mask outside in April of 2024, and she says, I need to get educated. That's why you're in college, I think. Anyway, I rest my case on that subject. When we come back, we're going to talk to a guy who's been paying attention to what's been going on college campuses for a long time. He says none of this should be a surprise because it's part of a plan. Stick around. We've also, we've now almost reached the point where it makes more sense to point out the colleges where there are no anti-Israel protests. There's more every day. It's a great TV show, and they're getting wall-to-wall coverage on the national news. Leo Leibovitz is editor at large for Talbot. I'm having trouble speaking. Sorry about that. He says Columbia, which seems to be getting the most attention here, is beyond reform. And Leo, he joins us now. Thank you for coming on, Leo. I'm struggling here. I hope you can help me. I'm having trouble speaking, which is kind of a problem when you're on radio, but we'll work on it. Thanks for coming on.
Well, it's a pleasure, but sadly, I'm not the bearer of good news.
Well, in your piece at City Journal, you say there are two urgent questions. How did we get here, and what do we do now? So why don't we start with how we got here?
I think that's the most troubling question of them all, because I think most Americans who are looking at this madness are assuming that it was, you know, some kind of monster from the deep scenario. All of a sudden, things got a little bit crazy, and really kind of a lot of people are wondering how this happened. But the troubling answer is that this is a feature, not a bug. If you think about this, Columbia's acceptance rate is 3.8%. This means that the university very, very carefully chose these precise students. This is part of a years-long or decades-long even effort by NGOs and lawmakers and political activists to turn a university from higher learning. into, you know, hotbeds of radical ideology, and you're seeing the results right now.
When you say, so 96%, more than 96% of the people who apply to get into Columbia don't get in. So they're obviously, they're very selective. And you say it's a plan that goes back a long time. What gives them the idea that they have the right student when they pick one over another for this kind of thing to end up on campus that we have now? What kind of student do they find?
First of all, you have to decide what kind of university you want. If you want an institution dedicated to the free and unfettered exchange of ideas and serious intellectual learning, then your criteria are very simple. You choose the best and the brightest people, irrespective of who they are and where they come from. You choose, to paraphrase a great American, based on the content of their characters, not the color of their skin. If, on the other hand, you want a purely politicized bastion of hotbed of radicalism, then you choose people who you understand would be most susceptible to this ideology that the professors you had also chosen will teach them and indoctrinate them with day and night. And this is exactly what we're seeing happen in Columbia and elsewhere.
Well, I'm old, but I remember when you applied to get into a college, and I wouldn't have gone anywhere near an Ivy League school coming out of high school, but you have grades, you have a transcript, you take the college boards and you send it in, and you tell them how many activities you took part in, and then they pick you or they don't. What could they be looking for from a high school kid that's going to make them believe years ago that this is exactly the kind of kid we need to carry out our plan?
So this is a question that I could actually answer somewhat personally. I went to Columbia University for my sins. I got my PhD there. I taught there for a while. I have a pretty kind of decent inside-looking campus. And, you know, I arrived precisely believing exactly what you believe, that this was a place that truly was very, very serious about picking all the right students. And then I started seeing that the ways that the students and the professors were picked had actually nothing to do with these qualifications, these objective qualifications that you so wonderfully and aptly mentioned. They were based on certain quotas for race, and we're seeing this right now in the host of big Supreme Court cases against Columbia and the other Ivies, in which Asian Americans, for example, said, hey, how come you discriminate against us and pick a really inordinate amount of black kids? How come you pick all these, you know, students who are sons and daughters of very wealthy Qataris or Chinese Communist Party officials? What's happening here in campus? And then you understand that it is a money game, picking the wealthy daughters and sons of, say, you know, people from Qatar or China or wherever is just a very good investment if they pay full ride. And second of all, it's kind of an ideological construct. You want, you know, an overwhelming majority of what they call students of color to show that you're so progressive and so wonderful. You want to make sure that you don't have too many Jews, which is why Jewish students in Columbia used to make around 20% of the student body in the, you know, late 80s and early 90s, are now, I think, under 10. You're playing a very ugly, very racist game that is truly shameful. And again, you're seeing the result right here, because these students know that they were picked not because of who they are, but because of some kind of radical ideology, which they're now happily serving. That's why you have the Hamas flag waving instead of the American flag on the flagpole on Columbia's campus right now.
It's crazy. Any chance this plan began with people, people from my generation, baby boomers, who kind of invented campus demonstrations? They went from protesters to professors and administrators. You know, they started out as protesters on campus as students, and then they were running the show.
I'm sad to say, look, I don't mean to sort of beleaguer an entire generation here, but there's something about the old saying, the old kind of student radicals in the 60s used to say, the right marched on Washington and we marched in the English department. They knew what they were doing. They seized control of these institutions, those, 60s radical leftists. And they made sure that using instruments like tenure, that universities will remain decades and decades to come committed increasingly to this kind of radical ideology.
And So, and they're getting old because I'm getting old, but they're still around, right? That's who's running these places. A lot of them are still the former
anymore.
College hippies.
It's a beautiful part.
Yeah.
Because, you know, tenure makes it so that you get appoint whoever you want, and therefore they also appoint whoever they want, and it's just copycats of each other for three, four, five generations hence.
And here's what I found interesting. Again, having been around for this, in the 60s and 70s, students protested against the U.S. government's involvement in, mostly it was the Vietnam War, but they were also protesting the United States and its racial discrimination, and they were protesting and demonstrating in support of the civil rights legislation, that kind of thing. So it was demonstrating for either against the United States or for the United States to do what they wanted them to do. This time it's a third party. And these demonstrations we're seeing all over the country right now, they're not demonstrating against the United States. They're demonstrating against a country that's thousands of miles away from here. It would be like a demonstration against South Vietnam in 1970. How did that happen?
You're both correct, but also I think there's a kind of a slightly larger point here, because when these kids take down the American flag and put up the Hamas flag, a flag of a terrorist organization designated as such by the Department of State in 1995, they're not just saying, hey, you know, we don't like Israel or we like Palestine. What they're saying is, we like terrorism. We do not approve of the American way. So the weird thing, because again, a lot of people are asking, you know, why in the name of Palestine would you take over an American university or disrupt the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade or the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree lighting? And the answer, I think, is because it was never really about Israel and Palestine. It is very much about America, but unlike the 60s radicals who just had a radically different vision of America, but still many of whom I think actually cared about this place and wanted to change it for the better, albeit in a very misguided way. These people straight up hate America. This is why in the University of Michigan yesterday, you had people passing around pamphlets that said, you know, black and white, death to America. This mm-hmm. is in Michigan.
Yeah.
These people hate us, and that's what these demonstrations are about.
Yeah, I think, again, to make a comparison to back when this stuff started, at least for me, there were communist organizations on campus and people running around talking about mm-hmm. Mao and how much they loved him, and you know, they were idiots too. But you know, I thought most of them would have grown out of that. But apparently, they're now either still calling the shots on college campuses, or they're retired and they've appointed people to carry it on for them. What was Obama's Dear College letter?
So this is an example, I think, kind of a lot of people let fall by the wayside, because it was one of these very complicated, you know, policy matters that schmoes like me like to just gloss over. But in 2011, the Obama administration wrote a so-called Dear Colleague letter to the administrators of American universities, basically saying, hey, guys, there's something called Title IX legislation, which is legislation, a very good piece of legislation here to make sure that there is no discrimination on the basis of sex. Guys, we're very afraid that there is rampant sexual violence on college campuses. In fact, here's a study that we could cite that says that one out of every five women on college campuses are sexually assaulted. Now, you hear that number, you think to yourself, oh my God, what is going on here? That is a shockingly large number. But then once you actually look at the single study from which the White House took this number, you understand that it was a complete kind of, you know, kangaroo research that offered people, you know, $10 Amazon gift cards to fill in like a brief survey, not at all a serious piece of science. Based on this, the Obama administration came and said, guys, there's a big problem. And because it's a big problem, here's what we're going to do. Rather than complain to the police, which is what we have been doing in case of, you know, suspected or alleged rape since, you know, the beginning of this country, from now on, we're going to empower colleges to basically set up kangaroo courts with peer-reviewed tribunals, basically judging whether or not men are guilty of so-called sexual assault. You will not be shocked at all to find that actually made accusations, the number of accusations of sexual assault, climb up precipitously because all of a sudden there was an incentive to go ahead and accuse men. The language of the dear colleague letter was very gendered, to accuse men of sexual harassment or worse, sexual assault. You would also not be shocked to learn that a vast number of these cases were found to be completely bogus. It's yet another example of how the administration, aided and abetted by the media and a whole slew of NGOs, took universities and turned them into a political battleground to advance very specific and very noxious progressive ideologies.
And that's now 13 years ago. So would you say that Obama should be included among the planners that you've talked about how this has been planned for decades?
Oh, I think there's absolutely no doubt about this. I think when you look at, first of all, Obama's milieu, best friends with people like Rashid Khalidi, a professor at Columbia University and the former below official who's, you know, very instrumental in sort of helping and kind of guiding these protesters and the whole atmosphere of anti-Semitism on campus. And furthermore, I think Obama had a very good grasp of how power worked and how you could use this kind of creation of, you know, sort of echo chambers to advance narratives that were completely false and yet helped reshape institutions radically. You saw this happening to American media in Obama's time. You saw this happening to American universities in Obama's time. You saw it happening to American politics in Obama's time. It became much more centralized, much more nefarious. And here we are. That's the world we're living in.
I wanted to say, I wanted to mention that before we got into the whole Obama and the Dear College letter, I wanted to mention to you that you wouldn't have heard it when I opened the show. I made the point here yesterday that having experienced demonstrations when they became cool many years ago, that it was my experience that at least half of the people who showed up were there for a party. They were there because it was exciting. There was stuff going on. Maybe you'd meet some chicks. You know, there were plenty of passionate people there, but there were just as many who couldn't care less, and they were there because that's a big gathering. So I ran a clip of an interview with a college woman at NYU, and the reporter says, "Why are you demonstrating here today?" And she says, "Well, we're demonstrating because we're in support of Palestine." And she didn't look like a radical. She looked like a clean-cut college kid. "We're here demonstrating to support Palestine." He said, "Well, what exactly is NYU doing that you're demonstrating against NYU?" And she said, "I don't know." And she turned to her friend, who was wearing a mask, by the way, and asked her, and she said, "I don't know. I need to get educated." And I rest my case on that, because when you look at these numbers, there's plenty of people there who are very much sold on this whole idea, but there are at least as many who are there observing. And also outside agitators, by the way.
So here's my one kind of question. I love this theory because, you know, it kind of suggests that these are just kids along for a good time at a party.
So many of them are, not, you know, all.
Give them another cause, and they'll be swayed elsewhere. But I want to kind of point out one thing that really sort of has been haunting me since this whole affair began. If you look at the picture of the so-called Gaza Solidarity Encampment on the college campus, Columbia University, the one thing that you notice is that all these tents, and there are dozens and dozens and dozens of them, they're identical tents. They're all exactly the same make and color. They're green Coleman, you know, pup tents, which means that someone went out there. These are not cheap. Someone went to REI or, you know, Cabela's or some camping store or an Amazon and ordered dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of these tents, and then got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these kids to come at the exact same time, set them up, and quote-unquote occupy the college campus. This suggests that you don't have to be, you know, an investigative journalist, because we don't have any more of those in America, to understand that someone's paying big money to organize these efforts. Now, it's not a big kind of question or mystery who. It's an association called Students for Justice in Palestine, with clear-cut, well-proven, documented ties to Hamas and other Palestinian terrorist organizations that are allowed with impunity to operate in American college campuses. Now, here's the thing. We have very easy, simple rules and laws on the books that allow us to take care of this problem. We could deport many of these foreign students who express, you know, clear and open support for terrorism organizations. We could suspend American students who do the same. There are no shortage of measures we could take to curb this. The problem is that neither university administrators nor, sadly, lawmakers choose to actually, you know, obey the law.
Yeah, hey, listen, Neil, I'm out of time in this segment. Can you stick around a few minutes during the commercial break?
Absolutely.
Because I want to talk to you about one of the things you mentioned, and that's deportations. We'll do that when we come back. Back with Leo Leibowitz. He's an editor-at-large for Tablet. His piece is up at city-journal.org about, and it's about the demonstrations and more specifically about what's happening at Columbia. And I wanted to ask you, you started to get into it a little bit there before the break, about some of the options that the government should have and should be exercising with or against these people. Deportations was one of the words I read.
Yeah, the government basically has two great tools at its disposal to make sure that we do not allow terrorist sympathizers to fly the flag of a terrorist organization in the heart of New York City and terrorize Jewish and Israeli students. Those two tools, very simply put, are defund and deport. The defund option is simple. You know, the taxpayers, American taxpayers, over the last couple of years have given something along the lines of $30 billion. To these Ivy League and elite universities, and all kinds of, you know, grants and other funds. The very least we could do is insist that if you're going to be an organization that receives tax money, you will actually follow, you know, U.S. law. And by which I mean to say, at the very least, expel any student who comes right out and say, hey, Jews, I wish that every day like October 7, I wish that each and every single one of you is raped and killed, which are actual lines repeated to Jewish students on Columbia's campus. The second option, deport, is a bit harsher, but I think very well justified. And it's very simple. Look, we have very specific laws that not just enable, but welcome foreign students to come here on a student visa so that they can enjoy our fine, world-class, elite universities, get an education, then presumably go back to their home countries and improve those economies or, you know, seek legal immigration here. When these foreign students come and wave a Hamas flag or say, you know, we support Al-Qassam Brigade, the Hamas military wing, or, you know, express in a very clear-cut manner their love and enthusiasm for an organization that the U.S. Department of State designated as a terror group, we have very, very, very clear laws on the books for a very long time. This is not controversial or radical or anything. That says that if a student cannot abide by these rules and is indeed found to be an aider and abettor to a terrorist organization, that student ought to be deported immediately. Now, the universities know this, which is why during several letters that they have put out since October 7th, which have been exposed in several of these committee hearings on the Hill that we've seen throughout the last couple of months, they have written specifically to foreign students, hey, guys, like, you should be very careful because you could be deported. So therefore, we ask that you keep your, you know, Jew-hating expressions to an absolute minimum. That's absurd. The university should be on the side of the law, on the side of the American people, not on the side of the terrorist supporters.
Yeah, so what percentage would you say, I know it's a ballpark figure and maybe an unfair question, but what percentage would you say of the people that we see on the news tonight are foreign, are not American citizens who are making the most noise and getting their pictures taken the most?
You know, it is very, very, very hard to tell because, you know, God bless America. It's a beautiful, gorgeous mosaic of people from all over. Some of them naturalized American citizens, some of them not yet. I myself am an immigrant to this great country. But I will say this, even if just one foreign student is deported, and students on campus, including Jewish students, see their administration, see their lawmakers taking this seriously, rather than Joe Biden putting out some mush-mouth statement saying, well, you know, it's really sad that they hate Jews, but it's really sad that they hate Palestinians. Hey, golly gee, I suppose it's just a big old messy cycle of violence and there's nothing I could do. Even if we deport just one terrorist sympathizer and show Jewish and American students on, and Jewish American students and others on campus that we are serious about this issue, I think that will go a long way in sending the right kind of message.
What is homo academicus? I guess it's academicus. Is that how you pronounce it?
That is a term. You know, sometimes there's a reason writers, you know, tend to drink when they write, because sometimes we have a little bit too much fun. That is a term that I coined.
Okay, and what do you mean by that?
I mean by that the sniveling, spineless, tenured coward who stood by at Columbia, at Yale, University of Michigan, and elsewhere, saw terrorist supporters taking over campus, saw Jewish students intimidated. On Columbia's campus, I know so many professors who really have nothing to lose. These are people with tenure. These are not people who are going to lose their livelihood. They're not going to lose their jobs. Nothing bad will happen to them. And instead of standing up, and one professor, very bravely, his name is Shai Davide. He has to be named out because he's the only person who stood out. But other than him, so many others, when they saw students intimidated, when they saw, you know, the marauders run amok at college campus, rather than say, hey, man, not here, not in our backyard, and not in our watch, they just kind of, you know, just took a step back and said, well, you know, it's complicated. There's nothing we could do. We could maybe work behind the scenes, but God forbid we would make our voices heard. And that, to me, is an example of moral, intellectual, and emotional cowardice and deficiency of the tallest order. And again, when you're thinking, is a university worth $250,000? Will my child get an education there? You have to remember that the people offering this education are people who are right now, this is not the Holocaust, it's not Germany 1938, it's New York City 2024, are standing by and doing nothing, where terrorist supporters tore down the American flag, put up the flag of Hamas, and are shouting, you know, Jews, go back to Poland. That is what we're dealing with. And these cowards also need to be, I think, punished once the dust clears.
We're talking to Leo Leibowitz. He's editor-at-large for Tablet. You can see his piece at city-journal.org. So, Leo, why do conservatives, people who disagree with what's going on college campuses, continue to send their kids there to these places? Are Jewish parents going to continue to send their kids to Columbia after this?
Gee, man, I really hope not. I've been writing and saying this since at least 2019. I have a 12-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I tell them, you know, three or four times a week, you are never going to college, because I'm not paying $250,000 and spending 4 years of your life for you to go to some place where mutually accredited mediocrities, you know, turn you into Nazis. Sadly, however, you know, a lot of Americans, including a lot of conservatives, suffer from an acute case of prestige addiction. They need that diploma with that fancy, you know, course of that Ivy League university. They still believe erroneously that a degree from Columbia or Penn or Harvard or Yale gets their kid a better shot at a higher paying job, which has for long been proven to be not at all true. They still believe that their kid will get a better education at Columbia. I think we're all seeing right now what kind of education Columbia gives its kids. I think the great, great lesson, and perhaps the only silver lining in this otherwise very, very dark cloud, is for more and more people, not just American Jews, but good, you know, God-fearing, America-loving Americans, seeing this go down and saying, hey, you know what? First of all, I'm never sending my kid there. Second of all, we should really think about building, you know, better educational institutions. A bunch of my friends are doing this down in Texas at the University of Austin, but there's still a lot of invention and creation to be done with making sure that we get the educational system we deserve and not one run by Hamas supporters.
Why do you suppose there haven't been any mass demonstrations to protest the cost of tuition, which has gone up like at three times the rate of inflation, or five times maybe. I might even be underestimating it.
Beats me. If I knew the answer to that, I would be on a totally different pay grade. I think they absolutely ought to be.
Yeah, but they're not. There's this big debate going on in the country right now about college loans being paid back, and what a terrible position these poor kids have been put in by having to pay for college, and that I should be forced to help repay their loans by the government coming in and taking my money and giving it to the banks or right. whoever they're giving it to. But there's no there's never any mention of what the tuition is at Columbia and what it was 20 years ago, and give me an explanation about what is it that happened in the last 10, 20 years that made Columbia worth so much more now than it was then. I don't hear any discussion about it.
No, not at all. And by the way, this is so ridiculous. You're so absolutely right. This is so ridiculous because these universities now have endowments that match the GDPs of, you know, small center European nations. These are not poor struggling institutions, and yet they receive billions of dollars in federal money, and yet they receive tuitions that keep on getting higher and higher and higher and higher. And no one says anything, because all this time, what are we busy talking about? We're busy talking about race, as if, you know, money didn't matter, as if hardworking Americans, you know, didn't care how much money they spend at these universities. It's an absolute trap.
Well, I put a call in today. I've made a couple of calls, and I haven't been able to get anybody to call me back. Carnegie Mellon University here in Pittsburgh has a branch campus in Qatar, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a story today. I wanted to ask you about this because you've been looking into this stuff, and Qatar funds lead to anti-Semitic demonstrations on campus. Late last year, it was reported that at least 100 American colleges and universities received approximately $13 billion in undocumented contributions from foreign governments. And the story noted, quote, speech intolerance manifesting as campaigns to investigate, censor, demote, suspend, or terminate speakers and scholars was higher at institutions that received undocumented money from foreign regimes. I haven't been able to get Carnegie Mellon to call me back. I've offered to talk to someone there to explain to me why they would have a branch campus in Qatar and how much money they've received as a result of it and what they do with that money. You know anything about what these schools are doing with that?
Yeah, I think it's as easy and as simple and as evident as it sounds. Look, the Qataris are very smart. First of all, you know, to those of our listeners who are not familiar with Qatar, here's the one thing you need to know about that country. It is currently the seat of Hamas's leadership, the people who planned and you know, gave the orders on October 7th to behead babies and rape women and kidnap innocent civilians. They sit in great luxury in billion-dollar mansions in Qatar. The Qatari government is very smart. It has a lot of money, and it figured that in America, the best way to get what you want is simply to buy it. And therefore, they started giving, you know, tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars, not just, by the way, to American universities, but also to American, you know, public schools. In New York City, for example, the other day, there was a complete storm because parents came to the class one day and they said, oh, hey, look, here's a map of the Middle East. Guess what? Israel's not in it. Who paid for this map? Oh, yes, the Qatari government. The Qatari government is now giving money to our public schools to teach our kids the Qatari/Hamas view of the world. And as you said, it's no surprise at all that once you receive that very, very hefty check, you'll say, well, gee, you know, I don't want to upset those nice people who just built me a brand new campus of Carnegie Mellon in Doha or whatever other universities in Qatar and vice versa. And so I'm going to be very sympathetic to these views. Again, this is something that the federal government should curtail. And again, this is something that the federal government does absolutely nothing about.
The name of the book, by the way, is America at War, 2024 to 2026, The Sons of Darkness versus the Sons of Light. And the author is Mark Billets. I now that I'm reading this, I should be getting him on the show. I'll be trying to do that. Finishing up here, Leo, where do you see this going, this chapter that's going on right now? Where's this one going to end? What's going to be the end of this episode that we're seeing right now all over the country?
Look, I wrote this very bluntly in my piece, and it sounds like a bit of bluster. And look, I'm not, you know, I'm not some kind of Luddite. I'm a person with a PhD from Columbia University who spent, you know, a third of his professional adult life teaching in these institutions and very much wanted them to succeed. But what I write in the piece and what I think is the end of this chapter and hopefully the beginning of a much brighter one is for all of us to realize that these institutions, these elite universities, are not sort of vaunted, valued public utilities that need to be saved at all costs, but rather they are national security threats that need to be dealt with harshly. Once we realize that, once we stop saying, oh, wow, let's get rid of this bad president because the next president will take care of things, once we realize that it's not going to happen because all these people educated by these institutions all see the world the same way. They have seeded generations and generations of people who hate America, who hate Jews, who want to turn these institutions into hotbeds of radicalism. What we need to do is to curb them. What we need to do is to build new and better institutions. And again, we have the laws on the books. All we lack is the resolve, and the lawmakers will use them.
Yeah, well, you're saying that colleges are on their way to becoming national security threats if they haven't gotten there already. That's some strong stuff, Leo. I appreciate you coming on to talk about it. People should check your piece out at city-journal.org and also find you at the tablet. Is it tablet.com?
Tabletmag.com.
Tabletmag.com. Leo, thanks a lot. Hope to have you on again.
My pleasure.
Okay, that's Leo Leibovitz, and we'll be right back. I see that Summer Lee won her primary last night. She's going to be representing the Democrats in the congressional election for her district, which includes Pittsburgh and Allegheny County. She'll be running again in November. And that's just it got me to thinking about what kind of world we're living in right now. She's a socialist, and she won. Democrats voted for her to win. Now, I don't know what the turnout was. The percentage of, I'm just going to take a wild guess and say it was probably about 30% turnout. I don't know what it was. Could be wrong about that. I forgot to check. But it's just another sign of what kind of world we're living in right now. And there are people out there in Pittsburgh and in the suburbs of Pittsburgh voting for a socialist to be their representative in Congress. This is where we are. And what the other place where we are is that those same there are people out there. This election, it used to be you'd have a discussion about if it was Richard Nixon against Hubert Humphrey. One was a Republican, one was a Democrat. They had their differing opinions on World War, on the Vietnam War, on taxes and social programs, and there were differences. But now you're dealing with someone who will look you in the eye and tell you that there's no evidence that men have an advantage over women in sports. And you're supposed to accept that. And there are people in the media who will say it with a straight face. And that's just one of the issues, but there are a bunch of them. But the fact that they would elect a socialist, that to me is enough. What kind of world are we living in? And by the way, as I say all the time, for you people here in Allegheny County, if you need me, I'll be in Washington County and maybe soon in West Virginia. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.